Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last year, a group of nearly 40 Iowa National Guard members stayed at Trump Turnberry, Scotland. Now, that's a luxury resort that markets itself as having one of the top golf courses in the world along the Scottish coast. A beautiful view there. Now, this Iowa National Guard stay at the resort took place during a plane refueling stop in Scotland. And it's now one of multiple trips under congressional investigation for potential conflicts of interest between the president's investments and government business. Let's talk about it with Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. He's been writing about this. Hi, Jason.
Oh, hi, Ben.
Tell us about, first of all, the nature of this stop in Scotland for the Iowa National Guard.
So this was the second trip that the Iowa National Guard took to Kosovo, and there is a partnership between the state of Iowa and Kosovo, and this was part of the trip. And on the way back, it was a little over a week-long trip, and on the way back from Kosovo, the plane needed to refuel, had to stop somewhere, and so the stop was in Scotland, and as part of that stop, the folks that were on the trip took a 45-minute bus ride to the Trump Resort to stay for the night.
And stayed overnight. You mentioned in your reporting also two Des Moines Register journalists were along.
That's correct. We had our columnist Courtney Crowder and a photographer Rodney White that had joined the National Guard on that trip and had documented, you know, their efforts and work with Kosovo.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the investigation. What questions are being raised by Democrats looking into this?
So the question is whether or not there is a violation of a constitutional violation. There's something called government emoluments, and that is it's a term that is used to question whether or not a government official has received gifts improperly. And so there are some strict provisions in law and constitution about, you know, what a government official can receive. And so the questions that have been raised, and this comes from the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Reform, is whether or not President Trump has violated that act. And so, you know, there's a lot of questions about that. But it is important to note that military troops have stopped and used that resort owned by President Trump, prior to his presidency. But that U.S. troops have stopped and used his resort in as early as 2015 and maybe earlier than that, but at least 2015 before he became president. So this is not something that is new. The question is whether or not the resort is being used at a much higher frequency. And so those are the questions that are being raised by this committee.
Mm-hmm. Does it appear that the frequency is higher now that Donald Trump is in office?
Well, that's yet to be determined, and that's some of the records that the House committee is seeking, is to determine whether or not there have been some inappropriate deals with the airport. The question is whether the airport and the resort have some type of working agreement, and if so, if that has resulted in a higher use of the resort.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the room rates, the charge for the rooms is also a part of this investigation. What can you tell us about that?
We know that the room rate that was paid by the military, particularly by the Iowa National Guard, was below the $166 per diem rate. Our journalist paid $150 a night, right at $150 for that night in the hotel stay. The Des Moines Register, just to note, did pay its own lodging. So that we didn't use National Guard money for that. But the room rate at the Trump resort generally is much higher than that. We saw room rates of more than $300 whenever we looked just this week. So there are certainly questions that the Congressional Committee is asking about that as well.
Right. And in following this story, I see that the U.S. Air Force has had a preliminary review of what they've been doing at this resort. I see in, what is this, either New York Times or Politico yesterday, up to 40 times since 2015. So this has got some legs. We'll be looking for follow-ups to this, right?
Absolutely. It's something that we'll be watching, and really it's made national news.
Mm-hmm. To note here, the Iowa National Guard leaving on Sunday. What are they doing?
That's right. So they're taking their third trip to Kosovo on Sunday. They'll return later in the month. This trip, however, their layover stop is in Spain, and it's on a they will be staying on a military base. So, presumably we will not be dealing with these types of questions again, at least on that trip.
Okay, Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now let's continue our 2020 caucus series, Home State View. This is where we learn about the 2020 candidates by talking with a news figure who has been covering them for some time in their home state. Now, there are three long-shot challengers at this point taking on President Trump in the 2020 primaries for the Republican nomination. Today, a home state view of one of them, former South Carolina Governor and Congressman Mark Sanford. Here to deliver our home state view of Mark Sanford is Meg Kennard. She is national politics reporter for the Associated Press based in South Carolina. Meg, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be with you.
Tell us about his, in a nutshell, his rise to public office.
Sure. Sanford originally began his professional career in real estate investment and development. That is something that he was doing when he first ran for Congress in 1994. He served a couple of terms in the U.S. House, was known for his views on fiscal conservatism, the same sorts of themes that he's kind of continuing on in his presidential bid in terms of bringing down the national debt and addressing the deficit. But in 2002, he opted to run for governor and served two terms in South Carolina before leaving office in 2010, and then a couple years later, re-entered Congress in a special election, won his old seat back, and served there until this past January when he left office.
Mm-hmm. How is he known to South Carolinians in terms of his leadership style?
Despite being a Republican in a state with a legislature that was also controlled by the Republican Party, as governor, Sanford had a fairly, I think it's fair to say, contentious relationship with the legislature. Again, he repeatedly and consistently voiced a need to hold down government spending. That's not something that oftentimes state lawmakers really want to do because it's their job to allocate state funding and to spend the state's money. But as governor, Sanford really continued to go along these lines of trying to keep those numbers down. He repeatedly and consistently would veto the state budget, sometimes all at once, sometimes line by line. But, you know, he really tried to continue to build that brand of, look, taxpayers, I'm trying to safeguard your money and not spend any more of it than we absolutely have to. So, again, that was an eight-year stint as governor that was sort of a fraught relationship between Governor Sanford and the Republicans in control of the state legislature. But it was a style that, frankly, I think was probably more popular when he was in the U.S. House for both of the times that he served, because that idea of being a fiscal conservative, of really wanting to safeguard, to hold down, to protect the taxpayer dime, that was a very popular stance for him to take to his constituents in the first district along South Carolina's coast in the Charleston area. And that was very popular. It won Sanford a lot of support and favor, but it was a little more difficult when that same idea set transitioned into a more executive role in charge of the entire state's coffers as opposed to just one of several hundred congressmen voting on a national budget.
Mm-hmm. Megan, you're nearly 20 years of covering Mark Sanford in his governor campaign, also as congressman. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned about the type of people he surrounds himself with, his team.
It's hard to know exactly at this moment who that team is. By his own admission, Mark Sanford has said lately that he really is kind of doing this almost completely solo at this point. He is looking to hire staff. Mm. With that also comes the need for money, which he would have to then do some fundraising to do that. But in times past, in his time as governor and then when he was in the U.S. House, Governor Sanford and Congressman Sanford, he's kept a pretty tight circle, I think that's very fair to say, of people who share his belief set. I mean, he really does hold strongly to these beliefs and thinks that that is, you know, a lot of politicians will have one or two issues on which they feel very strongly and they feel is really their path, their purpose, this is the reason why I'm here, is to really try to fight hard for XYZ issue. And in the previous times that he's been in public office, that's something that Mark Sanford has continued to try to do, to have people around him who believe that. And so, therefore, if they feel passionately about an issue like he does, they will fight for it as hard as he says that he wants to do. But at this point, I don't really know who those people are. We haven't seen him announce any sort of a campaign apparatus. He does have a staffer who has been kind of orchestrating a lot of the media that he's been doing, which has primarily been what his campaign has consisted of lately, of appearing on television. But he will be trying to do more traditional campaigning, and with that, he will need to try to figure out, okay, well, who are the people who are going to help me wrangle this? But as of now, it's pretty much Mark Sanford running Mark Sanford's campaign.
Mm-hmm. Meg, in this Home State View series, we always like to ask how the candidate in question, in focus, deals with criticism. So the criticism against Mark Sanford over the years and how he's dealt with it, I suppose, certainly in the national spotlight, we have to go back to 2009 and the reason he exited the governor's office.
Well, he did serve his full term in the governor's office. So while there was a cloud over the last probably about a year and a half of his administration, he didn't resign. He wasn't ousted. He was able to serve the rest of his term. But you're absolutely right. In the summer of 2009 and his whole, was he on the Appalachian Trail? Oh, he was actually in Argentina. That whole incident is, unfortunately for Mark Sanford, a lot of the reason why many people know his name. What some people may not realize is in the summer of 2009, Mark Sanford was actually in the beginning stages of preparing to run for president at that point.
Mm.
He was the head of the Republican Governors Association. He had become somewhat of a darling in the libertarian-minded part of the Republican Party. And there were already staffers who were starting to come to be in place here in South Carolina to start making the foundations for that. Obviously, in the summer of 2009, things changed, and his name was in the headlines for a lot of reasons that a politician and a lot of other people wouldn't want. So there was, of course, after that, a lot of criticism of Mark Sanford's personal life, of his personal choices, of his marriage fell apart, his wife divorced him. But he did stay in office, and he weathered it, and he went what we in the media kind of coined as an apology tour, and he's also used that verbiage himself, where he went around the state and spoke with a lot of people whose buy-in he had sought as governor and whose support he had needed to get issues through and who had expressed disappointment in him, frankly, for lying to the people and for going off on his personal endeavor that had nothing to do with them, yet they worried it had perhaps cost taxpayer time and money. And he went to them and expressed his severe apology and said, look, I know that you're disappointed in me. Please trust me to continue to be a steward of our government and to finish out my term. And he did.
Meg, to end this conversation, we often like to end on perhaps a lighter note. I'm not sure here, but we like to have you share something with your experience in covering Mark Sanford, something maybe on the footnote, the side of things, a little known aspect of Mark Sanford that perhaps doesn't get a lot of press. What comes to mind there?
It's been widely reported and talked about how in his first terms in Congress, he slept on a futon in his office in the Capitol building so as to save money. But one thing that I haven't seen as much talked about, but that we here in the press have come to know, is oftentimes as governor, when Mark Sanford would send information back to his staff, when they would send him a draft of something or he'd be sending back notes, he would put notes on post-it notes, as we often do, right, to draw someone's attention to something, but would require that everyone in his office use both sides.
We love frugalness in America. Thank you so much. Meg Kinnard, national politics reporter for the Associated Press, based in South Carolina. What a pleasure to speak with you, Meg. Thank you for sharing these insights about Mark Sanford.
Of course. Good to be with you.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Since 1967, over 1,500 riders from more than 150 countries have been in residence at the University of Iowa. It's all part of the UI's International Writing Program. Now, recently, another set of resident writers showed up for the IWP's 3-month residency. This year, 29 writers from 26 different countries. And I had a chance to talk with a number of these writers from around the world recently at a welcome gathering when they first arrived here in Iowa. And we're meeting them each Friday here on River to River.
Well, I'm Carlos Gamero. I'm from Argentina. And, I would say basically I see myself as a novelist, but I also write essays, literary criticism, short stories. I've done work for the theater, I've written some film scripts, and I translate.
What are the themes you like to work with?
Well, it depends. My first novels, in a way, composed a cycle that sort of centered on the last Argentine dictatorship, which ended in 1983, which I lived through. So I've got a series of novels, and they sort of conclude with what is known as the Falklands Malvinas War between Argentina and England, which sort of ended the dictatorship. But then, I know I've changed. My last published novel is set in the days of Shakespeare, and it's about Shakespeare's lost play that was based on Don Quixote, no, the great Spanish novel, which I thought was an interesting Argentine mix. No, English culture and Spanish culture meet in Argentina and also meet in my history, because part of my family comes from Spain, part from Gibraltar, another part from Italy.
Mm-hmm. And what brings you to this residency? What interests you?
Well, it's my second time here. I mean, I've done the residency before.
What year?
2008.
2008. So
yes.
More than
11 years ago.
11 years ago.
Yeah, and I had such a good time. Then when the opportunity arose to come again, I said, yeah, why not? Okay. I will be doing some teaching as well at Grinnell College.
Okay, so what are you looking for in this residency this time around in 2019?
Well, I'm first and foremost, I would say I want to write, which is what most of us come here for. I've been working on a novel for the last 5 years, and I want to finish it while I'm here. Also, it's a novel that takes you different places, and one of those places is Chicago and environs. So I also wanted to do some sort of research while I'm here, to go to some locations or search for some bibliography. And then it's a great opportunity to see my old friends again. You know, I never thought this opportunity would arise, you know, that I would be invited to do the residency again. Mm-hmm. And it's always great to meet all these writers from all over the world. I mean, the IWP is really one of the few truly international residencies you can find.
Mm-hmm. So you're interested in the Midwest and Midwest culture, or tell me more about that. You said the Chicago and environs.
Well, the thing is, my particular interest, my novel is based, begins with a true story about some natives from Tierra del Fuego, a tribe which had practically no contact with white men, who were abducted, taken to Paris, and exhibited at the Universal Exposition when the Eiffel Tower was built. And that was a sort of fad at the time. You had these Universal Expositions or world fairs, And there was a trend of what we call sometimes the human zoos. They would exhibit natives from different parts of the world, aboriginals, with their costumes, sometimes even with animals, sometimes in sort of park-like locations or in circus-like locations. But in this case, these Indians from the south of Argentina or Chile, we are not sure, were exhibited in a cage. And then something similar happened in Chicago. You had people from the Inuit, for example, from probably northern Canada, exhibited. And then there was an anthropological pavilion where the Kwakiutl also did their stuff. And I kind of thought it was interesting to find a connection between the far north and the far south.
Mm-hmm. Right, to Tierra del Fuego is the very tip of South America.
Absolutely. It's the southernmost part of the world, barring, of course, Antarctica. And also the culture of the natives of Tierra del Fuego. You had three different groups. It resembles that of the Inuit in Greenland and Canada and Alaska in many ways. So I thought it was an interesting story that connects in a way, you know, the southernmost part of the world with Europe and with United States and North America in general. Mm-hmm.
Since this is your second time, Carlos, here, how well acquainted do you feel Iowans or Americans are with your homeland, Argentina?
Well, at least here in
Argentina.
Yes. Here in Iowa City, of course, you find, because of this emphasis on literature and so many people coming from different parts of the world or the U.S., to study literature and writing, you find a lot of interest. As a matter of fact, when I was here the last time, I was able to complete a book on Argentine literature using the resources of the university library. The Borges Center, you might know Borges is the most well-known, probably the best writer in Argentine history. The Borges Center used to be here in Iowa City.
Really?
Yes, it was.
Well, how did it happen to come here?
Because Daniel Balderston, who is one of the great Borges experts, was teaching here in Iowa. Then he moved and he took the Borges Center to Pittsburgh, where it is now to be found. But the library here, in a way, has the testimony to that wonderful period. So you find an amazing amount of books and resources on Argentine literature, for example. Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about, you write about culture, of politics, you have. What are your thoughts about the U.S. at this particular moment in time? Many would see it as remarkable in many different ways, but how do you see it?
Well, I was here, when I was here for the first time, it was the time when Obama won the first election. So it's quite a contrast. Uh-huh. I'm not happy about, the present state of affairs of politics in the U.S. Quite apart from what it might do to the country, I think it set a trend which is problematic. Which is, I see that for the first time, at least to my knowledge, in the U.S. and a president is not speaking for the whole country, but trying to divide it, trying to say I am the president of a part of the U.S., not of everybody. This sort of divisive attitude is dangerous because then it's taken over. I think that after Donald Trump was elected here, Jair Bolsonaro was elected in Brazil, and Bolsonaro sort of drew inspiration from the politics of Donald Trump, for example. And it is a fact that the United States is a country many other countries in the world look to. And, the example is always important.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was my recent conversation with Carlos Gamero from Argentina. He's a writer taking part in this year's International Writing Program Residency at the University of Iowa. You can find out more about all the events offered over the coming weeks with these writers, 29 writers from 26 countries from around the world, by searching for IWP Iowa with your favorite search engine.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, do any of the trees in your yard have a personality? Well, this one certainly did. And that's why we want to talk about the passing of this particular and well-known tree personality. Remember that furious thunderstorm late on Monday night? Brought down tree branches and entire trees in certain parts of the state, including a beloved European larch tree on the University of Iowa campus, on the Pentacrest, as a matter of fact. Generations of children played on this enormous tree with its low-hanging limbs. Joining us to talk about it, Erin Irish. She is a University of Iowa Associate Professor of Biology. Welcome to the program, Erin.
Thank you, Ben.
And you have a close connection, I should say, with this tree. I want to wish condolences, and I'm not saying that in a jokey way, because a lot of us do have connections with wildlife and with plant species here. I understand you've been very close to this tree, and others have as well.
That's right. In fact, on my way to the studio, I noticed that someone had put a bouquet of flowers where the stump was.
Oh.
I even got an email from a former student who's now studying in Vienna, learning that the tree had come down and sharing his sadness with me.
So, Erin, do we know why this tree toppled with these winds?
It was rotten all the way through at the base. There was a big gap in the bark at the base, so you could see that it was just nothing but brown powder inside. So it was pretty clear that it was only going to be a matter of how many more storms can that hold up against.
And I understand you've been very close with this particular tree for many years.
Yes, I probably since the time I was interviewed on campus almost 30 years ago, I saw it then and I thought, wow, what a great tree. And I not only do I love it, I can tell that other people, it sort of reaches out to people as we interact on campus. And it's just, it's nice when you know that so many people are getting more and more separated from nature to have this opportunity.
Right. It really stands out on the University of Iowa campus, stood out because
yeah.
It is gone. It is no longer there. If you missed it, you missed it. It is gone. But describe the tree because it has these really broad branches, especially good for climbing, but just a beautiful architecture.
Yeah, yeah. So there are a couple other larches on campus, and they are they're pretty trees, but they are nothing like this example where there was a low branch that for whatever reason got the opportunity to grow out. I imagine a tree like that growing with other trees might have gotten shaded out on the lower branches, wouldn't have had a chance to grow. But this one, for whatever reason, had long branches that continue to grow way, way farther out than you typically find in such trees.
Sort of a pendulous and almost sort of swept up and almost horizontal in some
ways. That's
right. Something
right.
like this. Do we know how old this tree was?
The estimates are around 50 to 70 years old. There were a couple of branches that I saw the stump ends of in the dumpster as it was unceremoniously being hauled away.
Oh.
And I snapped some pictures and I tried to count rings, and it looks like one branch was 50, another one was 60 years old. And so 70 years is probably about right for that tree.
European larch is the species here.
Yeah.
I'm taking from the name that this is perhaps not native to North America.
Indeed. There is a larch that's native to Canada, but this is not it.
Okay. So this European larch tree, I read they can actually grow to quite advanced age.
I read that too.
Hundreds of years
old. 100 years, yeah.
100 years. Okay. So very good. And you have been in recent years, I understand, lobbying sort of to protect this tree from what?
Well, I noticed that branch that's so attractive has seen so much use of people enjoying climbing on it that the bark was worn off of the top. And the bark is not just this rough stuff. It actually is the living part of the tree. And I imagine that if it lost too much more bark, that branch itself would die, and then they'd have to cut it off, and the tree would look awful, and they'd have to take the whole thing down.
Oh.
So
I think, I have three adult children now, and I think when they were small, they were responsible for a little bit of that bark rubbing off because they loved that tree as well.
Right. Well, it was the catch 22. If you didn't have such a gorgeous tree, no one would have wanted to interact like it like they did with it.
Right. I understand you're maybe looking to replicate, to clone this tree. Is that the right term?
It is the right term, but that might be the word that I would replace with vegetatively propagate.
Okay.
Because what I just did, I collected some branches and I stuck them in water, and my plan is to put them in some rooting hormone and then put them in a mist chamber. I've looked at instructions on how you can make cuttings of trees, and it's it's not as easy as making a cutting of something like a tomato, where you could just stick it in a glass of water in a couple of weeks. It's got roots coming out of the cut base, but it's the same process.
So taking it from that way, a cutting is different than a seed. So the seed, it would not be a replicate of the mother?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so that's the difference. But what you're doing is, if successful, this would be an
actual clone, a copy of that tree.
Mm.
And that's the way all apples are. Each individual variety of apple is distinct. And if you were to try to grow one from seed, you wouldn't get what it came from. So every Red Delicious apple comes from the same tree that has been vegetatively propagated.
Mm-hmm. So how are these cuttings doing now? They're only a few days old, right?
They're still alive.
Okay. Thumbs up so far. Well, we wish you well, and maybe we'll get an update on this to see. I don't know. The University of Iowa let's suppose you get a seedling out of this. Why not put it back in the place where it was?
That would be wonderful.
Okay. We'll keep track of this. Aaron Irish, University of Iowa Associate Professor of Biology and lover of trees. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that. And of this particular tree, the European larch, unfortunately taken out by a storm, uprooted this past Monday on the University of Iowa campus. Aaron Irish, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the Cy-Hawk Trophy is on the line this weekend when the Iowa State Cyclones and the Iowa Hawkeyes face off this year. ISU has home field advantage at Jack Trice Stadium in Ames. Brandon Hurley is with us, assistant sports editor at the Carroll Times-Herald and sports editor for the Jefferson Herald. Brandon, thank you for joining us to give us a preview.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Let's start off with having you give us a preview of each of the teams as you see them. Start off with the Hawkeyes, why not?
Okay, so I think early on in the season, only two games in, I think Iowa's strength this year is their defense. They shut out Rutgers in the Big Ten opener this year, 30-0, so anytime you can do that, that's pretty huge. And they've also showed some pretty good balance on offense. They seem to even though they lost two tight ends to the NFL this past year, they have a pretty good run game and a strong pass game. So I think just overall, I think they present a lot of problems for Iowa State.
Mm-hmm. Right, and Iowa comes into this game ranked 19 in the Associated Press College Football Top 25 ranking. Let's pivot over to ISU. What do you have to say about that team?
I think Iowa State, they only have one game under their belt, so we don't have as much film on them. But once again, just like Iowa, their defense looks to be their strong suit. They held U and I to just 13 points in regulation. But on the other hand, their offense obviously needs to get rolling a little bit. They did lose Hakeem Butler to the NFL and David Montgomery to the NFL. And that showed a little bit. They only scored 13 points in regulation against U and I, though they do have Brock Purdy coming back at quarterback, who a lot of people are high on. So they need to get that offense rolling again, and I think it while it won't be a super low scoring game, I think it'll be more in probably the 20s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Comment on the one game, because ISU had a bye last weekend, the one UNI game, even though they did win in triple overtime. The Cyclones started the season ranked in the AP poll. Even though they won the UNI game, that was a loss, so to speak, in a certain way, right?
Yeah, it was definitely a scare for everybody involved in the ISU program and their fans. There was actually several times where they actually could have lost that game, and especially near the end of overtime. They were going for their game-winning touchdown, and they fumbled it on the goal line and luckily recovered and then scored a couple plays later. So, yeah, I think you could look at it two ways. It was a bad way to start the season, but it also gave them a game to actually be really competitive and show how they can perform when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more how these teams are balanced, to the degree to which they're balanced in their passing and running when you picture them facing off.
Yeah, I think they both should probably favor the run game a little bit at the start, because that's kind of just how these two programs get going. But they, like you said, they are pretty balanced. Iowa has more unproven receivers than Iowa State does. Iowa State has DeJounte Jones, who is obviously no Hakeem Butler, but he's a pretty great receiver for them, and he can go up and catch some balls. Iowa, on the other hand, they have recently they've had some other guys step up. Unknowns actually step up. Reggini, he stepped up and had some big catches, and so did Tracy last week. And so I think just that balance overall, I think, should prove to be a pretty exciting game for a lot of fans.
When the kickoff happens on Saturday, tomorrow at 3 p.m. at Jack Trice Stadium, you know, football fans, of course, very keyed into the first few minutes to see how these teams meet each other. What will you be watching especially?
I think I just to see how these two teams start. Iowa obviously has a strong defense. Iowa State, we think, has a strong defense. So whoever can get some momentum, maybe get on the board first, I think will really kind of be a turning point for the game. Iowa notoriously has kind of struggled recently in Ames. So if they can get out to a strong start, I think that bodes well for them. But on the other hand, if Iowa State can kind of keep Iowa's offense quiet, I think that with Brock Purdy being a mobile quarterback for them and pretty momentum heavy, hill, I think that'll help them.
Right. I looked over the last 15 years of games between in this rivalry. Iowa has won most of them. Iowa has won four of the last five games against Iowa State. We're at Jack Trice Stadium for this game. How much of an advantage in this case is the home field?
I think this is an interesting rivalry for the fact because these two schools are close together, only about 2 hours apart. The home field advantage doesn't really play that much into this rivalry. I know for a fact there will be a lot of Iowa fans at this game because there's a lot of it in Central Iowa. So I don't see a crowd noise being too much of an issue for either team, actually. I mean, they're used to this rivalry. They know how much hype is they're into it. The only benefit, I guess, really for Iowa State is that they don't have to travel. So when they wake up tomorrow morning, they have a short commute to the game. So I think that plays into their benefit.
Okay, Brandon Hurley, editing sports, the Carroll Times-Herald and the Jefferson Herald. Thanks for your preview, Brandon. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. I'm excited for Saturday.
Kickoff is tomorrow at 3 p.m. in Ames. Let's get into the spirit. Cue the fight song. Wait a minute. Which one? IPR certainly doesn't want to play favorites in this heated state rivalry. So why not play both at the same time? Here's producer Rick Brewer's fight song mashup. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, your source for great reporting, interesting conversations, and very occasionally a bad idea. I'm Ben Kiefer. This has been River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.